Hey, I'm in Japan. I'm Frank Ling.
And from Chicago, Illinois, I'm Charles Lee.
And you're listening to the Grok Science Show.
That's right. It's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives. Coming up on today's program,
Melanie and Lennar will join us to discuss life in the hothouse.
So stay tuned for all of this.
Plus the Grokatron 5000.
And our world-famous question a week.
Coming right up.
Here.
On the Grok's
Science Show.
Science Show. Well, the issue of global warming continues to be a major issue for the 21st century. How do we deal with the changes to our global environment? And more importantly, how's the Earth naturally equipped to deal with such changes to its environment? Well, joining us today to discuss this issue is Dr. Melanie Lennart. Dr. Lennart is an environmental scientist and award-winning journalist who specializes in climate change and forests. She has penned the new book, Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change, and she joins us today to discuss this very fascinating issue. Dr. Lennart, thank you very much for joining us today on the Grok Science Show.
Oh, it's great to be here, Dr. Lee.
It's really a pleasure to have you on the program. This is certainly a very fascinating book, Life in the Hothouse. I'm curious, maybe before we get into the issue of how the Earth is able to deal with climate change, what exactly is the current consensus regarding global climate change?
Well, among scientists, the consensus remains very strong. We know that the planet is warming. It's warmed by about a degree in the last century. And even though the incline, really a lot of this increase in the warming has come since about the mid-70s, and although we've had a little bit of a pause in the rise, it's not because we've gotten any cooler. The 10 hottest years in the instrumental record have actually all occurred since 1997. So when people talk about the trend dropping, it's just that we had such a hot year in 98 that between 98 and 2005, sticking up like poles on a football field, the other years don't look as dramatic. But in fact, they all are above average. We've had a lot of warm temperatures. And, you know, not coincidentally, in time to, as our greenhouse gas levels have been rising tremendously during that same time frame.
So it is definitely correlated, at least with the increase in greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, let's put it this way. Just figuring out exactly how much of that comes from the greenhouse gases is just a little tricky because the Earth is such an intense climate, but we definitely know that more greenhouse gases, greenhouse gases trap heat. So we do know, yes, that the greenhouse gases are trapping heat, and the fact that it's warming while these greenhouse gases are trapping heat makes perfect sense.
So what are the current predictions then for what effect this is going to have on the Earth's environment?
Interesting, because a lot of the predictions, we're already seeing examples of them. And of course, you cannot look at one particular disaster, for instance, and say, oh, that's because of global warming. But we're seeing a variety of things adding up. For instance, heat waves. We've been seeing some intense heat waves. There was one in Chicago, matter of fact, in 95 that killed about 700 people. And of course, in Europe in 2003, more than 30,000 people. Some are saying 50,000 now. So that kind of thing we're seeing, and while we can't say any particular heat wave is exactly traced to global warming, we can say we know we're going to get more heat waves and more extreme events like that. Of course, we've also got the hurricane issue. Well, storms in general. You know, a lot of people have been flooding this past spring. We had all this winter snow, which actually is more likely to happen in a warmer climate because warm air holds more moisture. So you would expect warm air to hold more moisture, and that's what we have been seeing. In fact, the precipitation has increased overall in the U.S. by about 7% over the last century. And interestingly, the number of extreme events, those top 1% of storms, have increased by 20% in that time frame. And among those, we've seen some strong hurricanes, which fit the concept that we expect stronger hurricanes. And that is partly related to the warming sea surface temperatures. These are the things that I'm talking about are pretty strong correlations. We also expect droughts to be more severe, which we saw here in the Southwest in the early 2002 and 2003. Just for that same reason that warmer air holds more moisture would be one of the reasons we'd expect more severe droughts. And we've seen those in other places too, Atlanta, you know, different places around the country. So generally there's more precipitation around the globe, but at any given place in time, you may or may not be hit by either a flood or a drought. Now, sea level rise, that's another one that's, we haven't actually seen so much of it yet, but that is just, you know that if temperatures go up, you're going to melt some ice at some point, and that is going to increase the sea level. So that is also going to increase the water table and lead to more flooding in general.
So this increase in very extreme events, these are increasing.
Yeah, I think extreme events is kind of a good way to think of it. And we see that with fires, too. Like in the West, we've been getting some really extreme fires. In Arizona in 2002, we had 500,000 acres of really big burns, where usually the fires used to go through these forests and just sweep across the forest floor. Now they're taking down trees in 5,000-acre parcels. And part of that is how we manage our forests and that we've tried to keep fire out of them. But it has also been linked to earlier snow melts, just linked to bigger fires, which makes a lot of sense because the snow melts earlier, and then if it's dry, it gives the forest a chance to dry out and catch fire.
Suggested that this is kind of a natural mechanism for the Earth to deal with these changes, what you call sort of a feverish response.
Yes, well, some of the things I've been talking about, like the fires wouldn't necessarily be expected as a natural response, but I think that's why I tend to suspect that it has a big role with the lot of small trees we have in our forests, and that if we would make those forests more resilient, things might go better. But in general, I do use that argument of that just a lot of these things, there's two lines of looking at this. One, there's some balancing mechanisms that the Earth has, and in particular, I argue for the role of forests and wetlands, because they're just tremendous at taking some of these greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, out of the air and storing them in the trees and in the soil. So that, you know, it's interesting that during warmer climates, well, even on our current climate, you can look at the tropics and you'll see where it's moist, there's lush rainforest. And in cooler climates, you get less growth. And that held when you look at climates of the past, the ice ages, the forests contracted, forests and wetlands. They just contracted, in wetlands case, some of them down to nothing. And then during warmer periods, and I actually look at some of the periods when there was no ice on the planet, so the hothouse periods, when sea level was several hundred feet higher, and we had a lot of different changes going on, more precipitation in general too, well, we also had more forests and wetlands during that time. So I argue it, the planet has a reason for, you know, that these systems have a reason for being in those time frames, and in fact they do actually work really well with the floods we would expect. Both forests and wetlands are great at absorbing floods, so that would just be such a wonderful thing to have it anywhere around in your cities, for instance, in coastal areas. They also are good at blocking the wind. Subject to hurricane winds, you'd really want to try to have more forest between the coast and the city as much as you can. And of course, in cities, one of the things we don't want to forget is they actually cool the place. They've got shading, and they do evaporative cooling by evaporating water. So it just makes sense for those systems to be around. Now, that's talking about the balancing mechanisms. There's also the issue that there may be tipping points that hit, and that sometimes these systems are still probably, there's a good reason to suspect they're useful for what's going on, but there may be a point where sometimes they're just responding to the physics of things. And that, for instance, would include the warming as permafrost melts, got some of the wetlands up there warming out, and they may be releasing more methane as a result, which is a greenhouse gas. And that would not necessarily be a balancing mechanism, but just something that the Earth does and then is adjusting to that. It's just something that does happen and has happened in the past.
I see. So it's sort of like runaway warming or runaway cooling when you go into ice age periods.
That. Yeah, and the way you put it with runaway is good, and I tend to think of them as like tipping points, because it does look, there's evidence that planet actually does have some particularly stable climate conditions, the ice age being one of them, like you mentioned, where you look at some of those ups and downs that show that how the ice cores temperature fared during the ice ages and the interglacial warm periods, you'll see they kind of stabilize at roughly the same place. So there seems to be a low they drop to and then stay there, and then a high they go to and stay there. And there's a lot of in-betweens, but there's just a certain level. And we find the same thing with the hothouse periods, where the planet seems to stabilize at a certain condition that's actually much hotter overall. I mean, the temperature for the planet as a whole might be 20 degrees warmer. So putting it at 80 degrees for the global average, I mean, that's kind of outrageously hot, really. And then, so you've got that, but also more moisture. If it's warming that much, you've got about, the air can hold about double the amount of moisture that we have now. So you can imagine the storms you can get in a climate like that. And I like to think of it as the sweat of the earth, which is actually easier to illustrate going to climate before plants, but let me just do that first then. So just as we sweat to cool off, and we do because when that drop of water evaporates, it takes with it some heat. The earth, very similar thing with it, the evaporation that eventually leads to precipitation. So basically climatologists are aware that circulation of different storm systems that we get around the planet go back to redistribution of heat, mostly from the tropics to other parts. And of course hurricanes fit in there really well because they're redistributing heat from the tropics further out on the globe. And so not only are they moving the heat that they've evaporated, but they're also cooling the water by pushing some of that warm water down. So that's one way the earth sweats, if you will. And then plants are another one. I mentioned how they can cool cities. Well, they actually also evaporate water from their leaves. That's part of their evaporative cooling and just works with their photosynthesis. And that can cool the air by usually 4 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And then on top of that, they're also shading things. So the shade itself, now we're talking not the air temperature, but the surface temperature can differ by 30 degrees or so on a hot summer day when you compare under shade, the surface of your skin or the surface of the ground, to exposed to the sun. So yes, I would argue that these are mechanisms that the earth has so that life can, for whatever reason, some of them it just comes out from physics, but it helps to keep the system livable, let's put it that way.
Isn't this somewhat paradoxical? I mean, wouldn't climate change actually threaten a lot of these systems, the forest and wetlands?
Well, that is something that I think that people are getting from their models for the most part, which are not always rooted in reality. Now, let me distinguish. There's atmospheric ocean models, there are coupled atmospheric ocean models, and those are very sophisticated. They've been under construction for the last 30 years. They're compared to reality, and those are the ones that are telling us what temperature's probably going to do. They produce a range for us. So like a doubling of greenhouse gases, we'd expect somewhere between 3 and 8 degrees Fahrenheit. And it, you know, usually comes down right about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And that would be the kind of doubling we're expected by about mid-century if we keep it up as we're going now. But the other models, the ones that are trying to work in the vegetation, those are much less sophisticated. They're rather rudimentary. And they're not, at this stage of the game, they're not even necessarily hooking them into reality and going back and comparing how does planet really respond. So I would just argue that we need to look at what the planet is really doing and what it has done in the past, because one of the things that is often left out of some of those models is the effect of carbon dioxide itself on plant growth. If you look at the evidence from past climates, there's very strong evidence that plants evolved to take advantage of the higher carbon dioxide levels. I mean, even in our modern research, in studies that have been done, hundreds of studies have shown that plants generally grow better when under higher carbon dioxide levels. So the levels for about mid-century plants grow on average maybe 40% faster. So that is just not being considered in a lot of the models I've seen, and it makes a big difference. I've seen some models by Ron Nielsen out of the Pacific Northwest lab, and I have a lot of respect for these. Basically, what he shows is the West could either be brown and dry with the coming climate warming, or if you try to include what the carbon dioxide levels, how that's going to impact, then they could be green. So it's a big factor that we don't know enough about. And we tend to do our experiments on either increased carbon dioxide levels or increased temperature levels. And you don't see those paired enough. And we really need to look at that together, because I think we're not giving the plants enough credit for what they can do in this environment.
If the plants, forests, and wetlands drive towards more of a stable equilibrium, do we actually need to be worried about global warming? Do we need to cut our emissions, or will the Earth naturally take care of itself?
Well, we definitely need to cut our emissions, even if we wanted to do it with the idea of trying to bring it in the range plants can deal with. Right now, they're pulling out. Plants in the ocean are pulling up about 60% of the fossil fuels we're emitting, and so that's a big deal. That means 40% of it's staying in the air, and we are feeling the effect of that, so it's not enough. The plants can't do it all, especially when we're burning them and cutting them down. And in fact, some of the ways, like I talk about how forests and wetlands expanded in earlier climates, but now we've got cities along the coast, and the wetlands have already been destroyed, and we're seeing the problems with that, such as in New Orleans, where not only are the hurricanes coming in stronger without enough wetlands to protect them, but also their land is sinking because wetlands are part of the sediment trapping system. And then we've got the huge dead zone we get every summer in the Gulf of Mexico, whereas if we had more wetlands along the coast as well as along the Mississippi River used to wind around wetlands, which would clean the nitrogen out. Now the nitrogen fertilizer from the Midwest kind of just gets channeled straight down into the Mississippi, where plants that we don't really care for, algae, go feast upon it and leaving a dead zone behind. So the problem is what we're doing, and, you know, another issue is if you want to try to grow wetlands, here in the West we've got the Colorado River doesn't even make it to the Delta anymore. So we're not leaving enough water in the system for the natural effects to occur in many cases. So we should be worried, and we should work on both ends. We should be reducing our greenhouse gas levels and our fossil fuel emissions, and working to adapt to the warming that is ongoing and is definitely going to continue for, we're expected to warm up at least another couple degrees Fahrenheit just because of what we've already got in the system.
Mm-hmm. So what would be the recommendation then for society as a whole then to bring our emissions down to that level which the plants can deal with?
Yeah, that would end up, if let's say if we were going to cut the world's emissions in half, that would mean in an industrial country like ours, we'd actually have to reduce ours about 80%, because if you're going to give everybody an equal share of carbon in the world, which only seems fair. But the nice thing is you can kind of do some of these things at the same time, and actually Chicago is a good example of that. So kind of in response to that big heat wave in 95 that killed hundreds of people, the city started looking at, well, where is our problem, and started planting a lot of trees and doing this green roof, setting it up so they're promoting green roofs. So the green roofs, which, you know, you've got plants growing on the roof, it tends to keep things cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter, as do trees in general. What you've got is a moderating effect from the vegetation, even while they're also taking up some of the carbon dioxide in the air and therefore mitigating some of the problem. They're actually decreasing the warming. At the same time, they're making the area more resilient to the warming that is coming.
If we can increase the amount of forest plants, then of course that helps sucking out the carbon from the atmosphere.
That's right. It helps there, and it also helps with staying cool so you don't need as much air conditioning. And if you've got a tree sheltering you from the winds in the winter, then you won't need as much cooling, for instance. And so, you know, all those other things that people talk about fit in, getting good insulation, using the breezes more in your house, like letting your house cool off at night, opening it up in the summer, say. There's just a lot of things we can do as individuals that can really add up to a difference overall. And everybody knows the less you can drive, the better. So some of that just ends up working out so nicely for not only the planet, but also your own life. Like, for instance, if you move closer to where you work and you only have to drive 5 minutes now, or maybe you walk instead of an hour, how much nicer is your life going to be? And it still also helps the planet.
Indeed. We are really slightly out of time. I'm curious if maybe you can just sort of distill some of these points as a take-home message for reduce their carbon emissions.
Yeah, well, some of the fluorescent lighting, you know, switching to that, which is nice and easy because you cut down on your energy bills, too. They only use about a quarter of the energy for the same amount of light. One thing I've been finding is that when I'm heating and cooling my home, I just close the vent to rooms that we're not in. And that way you don't waste energy and you can make the room that you're in warmer. So that's just a nice, easy thing to do. Some people might have fireplaces they can use and doing things that way. And carpooling is always good, but so is taking the bus. Then you have time to read, or maybe I know you got the Loop in Chicago, and maybe other people have train systems. And walking is great exercise. So, you know, all those things are good. And then planting trees and taking care of things around your home, and really even thinking about growing some of your own food whenever possible, just because then you're not pulling, you know, sometimes our food is traveling cross-country. I know here in Arizona, there's lettuce that goes from Yuma, it'll go all the way to the Midwest before coming back to Tucson, which is only a few hours away. So our distribution system is really not great. Anything you can do to buy local food saves on greenhouse gases of transporting food. And, you know, if you can get into just buying a piece of land somewhere that you can just let grow, let the trees grow, let the wildlife enjoy it, maybe you have a little place on it, and maybe you team up with people to do that. I know that's out of the reach of many people's budgets, but it's just something to think about as something that can help the planet and give you a place to escape.
Well, good advice. The new book is called Life in the Hot House, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. Dr. Menard, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the Grok Science Show.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Lee. I really appreciate your interest.
And you're just listening to Melanie Menard discussing life in the hot house. This is the Grok Science Show. Coming up in just a few minutes is the Grokatron 5000. So stay tuned.
Time to play the game, the Grokatron 5000. It is our supercomputer, formerly known as Deep Blue. Today, Grokatron 5000 has chosen the topic, heating up or cooling down. So for the following five items, the Grokatron 5000 would like to know if you think they're heating up or cooling down, and a little reason why. Dr. Leonard, are you ready to play the game?
Okay, I'm ready.
All right, here we go. Item number one, heating up or cooling down, it's the iPad.
Oh, boy. I would think it'd be heating up since it only recently hit the market.
Good news for Steve Jobs, then.
If that's true. I'd like one. I don't have one yet, but I'd like one.
Right. Item number two, heating up or cooling down, it's Texas Hold'em poker.
Well, I like poker, but I haven't played Texas Hold'em much, so... But it sounds like something I hear my buddies talking about, so I'll guess I'm going to guess heating up.
Okay. All right, item number three, heating up or cooling down, it's the ShamWow.
The ShamWow. Boy, this one is just over my head, I'm afraid. I don't even know what that is.
It's an infomercial product, so I guess that means it's probably cooling down.
Let's say that. Yeah, I'll call it cooling down.
Okay. Item number four, reality television shows.
I kind of hope they're cooling down at this point, or they should be doing reality TV about how does global warming affect you. But from what I've seen, I think cooling down would be a good thing.
Okay. And finally, number five, heating up or cooling down, it's the pop star Lady Gaga.
Well, she still seems to be pretty hot. I just saw her on Time or something the other day, and so I guess I'm going to say she's at least staying stable, maybe heating up.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Leonard, I want to thank you very much for sticking around, playing our game, and again, of course, talking about your new book, which is called Life in the Hot House, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Have a great day. Bye.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Grok Science Show.
Make sure you tune in next week for more from the world of science and technology.
If you'd like to contact us here, you can email us at science@groks.net. For Grok Science, I'm Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee. Make sure you also see us on the web at www.groks.net. Have a great afternoon and keep on grokking.